it's a great pleasure, and no doubt an honour, to have a chance to talk to Michael O'Sullivan, who I've known for some years. And I always ask at the beginning, when and where were you born?
I was born in Birmingham in December 1958.
And I also then ask about ancestors, and you don't need to go back to the Tang Dynasty or even to the English Civil War. It's really people who might have influenced you, your grandparents' generation or above, mm-hmm. who, knowing something about them, would help the viewer to get some idea of your ancestry. Where would you like to start?
I know a bit more about the Irish side than the English side. I'll go back briefly to how my father came to be born in the part of Ireland where he was born.
Yeah, that would be good.
Okay. So I'm Irish on my father's side and English on my mother's side, but having been born in Birmingham and grown up there, I've always felt mainly British. My father was born on a farm in County Galway, Ireland, and more recently some of my family did some ancestor research and discovered that the O'Sullivans of that part of Ireland were the remnants of the scattered, defeated army, defeated by the English at the Battle of Kinsale. Because the O'Sullivans originally come from the southwest of Ireland.
Is the Battle of Kinsale the Civil War? Is it Cromwell? Or?
Yes, it was when it was the last big military defeat for the Irish, which effectively led to the English ascendancy in Ireland, and many O'Sullivans and others were displaced. And I believe three ancestors then moved to what's now County Galway, married locally, therefore acquired land, and many generations of O'Sullivans have farmed the same corner of northern County Galway where my father and his brothers were raised. During the war, the Second World War, the economy was rather depressed, and my father took up the opportunity of war work in England, where young men arriving from Ireland were assigned work but guaranteed a job. And he was assigned to Birmingham to work at the Lucas factory, producing, I think, munitions and also keeping fire watch on the roof. So although a neutral as an Irish citizen, he found himself with a bucket of sand on the roof of the Lucas factory in Birmingham. He always regarded Ireland as home, never acquired formal British citizenship, and always referred to Ireland as home. But he married my mother, an English Catholic, whom he met at a parish dance, and therefore never returned, because they settled down and had children in Birmingham.
He was a Catholic, I'm saying.
He was a Catholic and a practicing Catholic all his life, as was my mother. My mother was the daughter of a woman who was an English Catholic. I don't know much about the ancestry on my mother's side. They were Herberts, so I would guess that somewhere is a Norman lineage, but they came from the Birmingham working class, so all my known relatives in Birmingham were what was then called Birmingham working class, and they were all, as far as I could tell, 100% English, whereas all my other relatives, close ones, were in Ireland on my father's side, although I gather branches of the O'Sullivans went to America and to Australia. So I was born in Birmingham, second of four children, in a semi-detached house in the North Birmingham suburb of Erdington. In those days, children were mostly born at home, unlike now. I think the policy was that the first child was born in hospital, and if all went well and all seemed regular with the pregnancy, subsequent children were delivered at home by a visiting midwife, who I recall lived around the corner. Of course, I don't recall that from my own birth, but from the subsequent birth of my siblings, who were delivered in the same front room by the same midwife. So that's how I came into being.
Tell me something about, did your mother have a job or work at any time? Or
she did. My mother was a very clever person. She was one of a large family. Her mother died early in rather sad circumstances. So her father had a low-income job, I suppose. So she had to give up education.
He was in the factory, or...?
He was doing, I believe, factory work, yes. But money was certainly in short supply. And she had to give up her education at around the age of 17 in order to be a surrogate mother to her younger siblings. Mm. She was the oldest daughter in the family. I discovered my mother's educational excellence actually as a teenager, rooting through a cupboard at home, and I found a book prize that she'd won for coming top of her class, I suppose, at the age of 16 or so, shortly before she had to give up her education. But she's the sort of person who would certainly nowadays go to university and do well at university, but of course in those days that was much less common. She left education, learnt typing at Commercial College and shorthand, and even when I was small and had one older sister and a younger sister and brother, she still used to take in typing work from a local law firm and copy type. I remember her tapping away on one of those old manual typewriters, copying documents with rather impressive red wax seals on them, and occasionally going with her to pick up or return work from the law firm about a mile away where we lived. My father always worked, but my mother worked at home, I suppose, on a piecework basis.
What did your father do?
My father completely changed his work. So he started as a farmer or a farm boy. But they did own land in Ireland. And then his war work was industrial. But after the war, he joined a financial company. So he was involved in loans and hire purchase and rose to become the manager of a branch. I think it was an extremely small branch. I think it was my father and one or two other people, but I do remember that when we travelled back to Ireland, as we did most years, it was made to sound very good. I think it's usually the case with the diaspora that when they go home, they make it sound a bit bigger than it really is.
Did the firm have, the firm in general have a name, or?
Yes, yeah, so when he joined it, when I was small, I recall it was called Practical Credit Services and was later, I think, bought by something larger, and then by the time he retired, I think at the age of 65, it had become Provident Financial Services. I think he was quite good at it in that my father had the famous Irish charm. He could talk to anybody of any background. He was a very honest person and a sort of rather kind person. But I think it stood him in good stead, persuading hard-up people that they oughtn't to get into arrears. I think it was all done with a good deal of charm and sympathy. And after he retired, he actually worked a lot for victim support. The charity that looks after the victims of crimes helps elderly people improve the security in their homes or file insurance claims and so on. He used to claim when he was about 70 that his victim support work had put him in such good standing with the local police that he was in no danger of ever receiving a parking ticket or being apprehended for any other misdemeanor.
Tell me about their characters and how that might have influenced you. I mean, you mentioned your mother, very clever. Did she encourage you with books and reading and university and so on, or...?
Yes and no. My mother certainly encouraged me in my early education. I remember well, she used to talk to me a lot, read to me a lot when I was small, which must have been quite difficult considering the load of housework and and typing at home. And later, when we were when we children were a little older, she took part-time work as a school lunch supervisor at a nearby school. She was always working and went back to work quite late in life as a full-time typist at the county courts in Birmingham, which is where she eventually retired from. So she must have made quite an effort, as I was one of four, and she had a lot else on. But I do recall her reading to me a lot and encouraging me to use the local library. I don't think I needed much encouragement, but I'm sure I recall getting some from my mother. On the other hand, both my mother and my father were not directive in regard to my education, so I don't recall them ever expressing an opinion, never mind an instruction as to what I should study at school, or nagging me about homework. They assumed I would do the right thing. And as I progressed in education, I suppose to a formal level beyond where they had reached, they became even less likely to offer advice or instruction. My father, on the other hand, while he was not at all directive about my education, loved to take hold of any certificate that I brought home from school to show that I'd achieved anything. And these certificates would disappear for several days, and we realised they were being shown round in the pub in the evening. That Irish social habit, so his Irish generation had a social habit of going to the pub after work, usually not for very long, but for one on the way home. And these certificates would be passed around. I still don't know what commentary was given. I can only guess, but they would come home slightly crumpled or dog-eared several days later, but they were always returned. So I suppose that gave me a sense of what's now called positive feedback. I don't think that was the term we used at the time, but we used to joke about it.
So they were both supportive parents and good parents?
They were. The only time they influenced my educational choices, and quite significantly so, although I suppose in a way at the behest of someone else, was when I reached the age of 11, the point of moving from primary school to a secondary school. And this, of course, was the age of the 11 plus. So naturally I went to the local Catholic primary school, and I took the 11 plus as we did. I think I did quite well. I certainly passed. I think it was pass-fail. My form teacher at school, who wasn't a Catholic, not all the teachers in the school were Catholics, told my parents that I was very promising and I ought really to apply to go to the King Edward VI school in Edgbaston, which was
a very famous school.
A famous school with an excellent academic record, I think quite intensively academic. It was a boys' school at the time. The alternative was to go to the boys' Catholic grammar school, St. Philip's, attached to the Birmingham Oratory. Also a good school, but not as intensively academic as King Edward's, but Catholic. And as I recall, my parents were not of a strong view one way or the other, but something that was in their head was a paranoid, kind of paranoid fantasy. So no, I didn't feel troubled by surveillance at all. I got used to the lack of privacy and learned to manage it. I learned how to disappear and go off radar sometimes, which for my sanity I needed to do.
Right, so this is 84. You come back here.
Yes.
Is that when you did your MLit in
Cambridge? I did MPhil in Cambridge. Yes, learning Chinese was interesting. I learned quite a lot in the 2 years I was in Hunan, and I'd started to become interested in linguistics when I was at Oxford. I did some papers, optional papers, towards my degree. So I thought it'd be quite interesting to go back to university and do some linguistics. Maybe I'd find I liked it enough to follow an academic career. But I was quite pragmatic about it. It was difficult to see how you could apply for a job back in the UK in those days if you were living in China, because there was no email. The journey was long and expensive, and you weren't likely to persuade anyone to employ you by writing letters from the middle of China. It wasn't even fashionable or even, dare one say, normal to be living in the middle of China wearing a Mao suit. So I thought it was pointless to try and apply for any attractive job, not that I really knew what I wanted to apply for, but made a lot of sense to go back to university. I didn't go back to Oxford because the linguistics master's course was 2 years long and I didn't want to make a two-year commitment, I wasn't sure. But I learnt that Cambridge had a one-year master's in linguistics, and I thought, well, I'll certainly enjoy the course, I'll like the place enough, and I'll find out whether I want to carry on doing academic work. And if I don't, I'll be applying for jobs as an Oxbridge student, not as a sort of weirdo in the middle of China writing letters with stamps all over the back of the envelope. So I suppose that was quite a practical way of approaching it. Actually, there was another reason that I hadn't thought of at the time, which was a good reason for going to Cambridge, and particularly going to Wolfson. I chose Wolfson with a bit more information than I had when I applied to Oxford as an 18-year-old, because I obviously knew a bit about universities. I applied to Wolfson because I thought I would enjoy a mature modern college more, having already been to a medieval college at Oxford, and that as an older student with some certain amount of life experience, I might not fit in going back to a place that was full of people like I, you know, as I had been 3 or 4 years before. So I chose Wolfson quite deliberately, but I think it turned out to be a very good choice because there were lots of international students even at that time in Wolfson. There were quite a few students from China and the wider Chinese world, and this turned out to be very valuable to me because I found that my experiences from China were so strange to most people here as to lose their attention after a minute or two. They would ask you politely what it was like, and as soon as you tried to explain it, typically people would switch off because it was just so outside their frame of reference. And I think I would have been distressed if I hadn't had a few people around who could listen sympathetically and actually believe that what I was saying was accurate and not some sort of paranoid fantasy. So Wolfson was a good choice for.
And you enjoyed the linguistics course?
I did enjoy it, yes, and I got through it, I did it, I got my MPhil, but I did conclude in that year that I didn't want to settle down to university life. But I did find my next move, which was joining the British Council, really more from a love of or an interest in working with China than the British Council itself. The British Council I got to know while working as a teacher in China, because they lent us books and were generally helpful. And I thought it would be a very interesting way to go back to China, so I joined the British Council because they said I would be guaranteed a posting to China within a couple of years of joining, since I could already speak some Chinese. And that was what made me drop other ideas of various careers and decide to give that a try.
So you joined the British Council, and how long was it before you went back to China?
It was not long. I worked for 18 months in headquarters on a trainee posting. I was assigned to the department that oversaw relations with communist countries, which included China, but otherwise East European countries. That was quite an interesting job. I was briefed by the relevant departments to brief British lecturers who were going to Eastern Europe behind the Iron Curtain, advised them on the various perils that might await them in Prague and so on. And I found that quite interesting, and it had a little bit to do with China. Then after 18 months, I was given a posting to Beijing that would begin a few months later. And I asked and was allowed to take 6 months off for language study to improve my Chinese ahead of working in Beijing. And British Council was very flexible. They let me go to Taiwan, which I arranged myself for 6 months, and enrolled as a student in university in Taipei. I chose to go to Taiwan simply because I'd found out that in Taiwan you could live normally amongst Chinese-speaking people. Whereas in China at that time, if you went as a foreign student, you were in a certain category. You'd be put in a building full of other foreign students. You'd eat with other foreign students. But in Taipei at that time, I could lodge with a local family. I could have all my social life with local people. So I effectively went to Taiwan for 6 months and spoke almost entirely Chinese and nothing else every day. So I arrived in Beijing as a British diplomat with a suspicious Taiwanese accent, but I was quite fluent.
What year was that, 86?
87.
87.
Yeah.
Interesting time to go. You were with the British Council for how long? Until 2007, so... 20 years.
No, I was with the British Council until, 2007, precisely so.
20 years.
Yes, just over 20 years.
Yeah. So, had it changed already by the time you went back in 87? Well, you were going to Beijing, of course, which was different. What was your reflection on going to Beijing in 87?
Well, the first thing I found was that it was... quite frustrating, because in my first 2 years in China, which weren't far in the past, I'd lived amongst Chinese people in a Chinese unit. I'd really been in China. At that time, when I'd briefly stayed with a British Council staff member in Beijing, who kindly put me up one for a couple of days when I was in the capital, I'd been very taken with the what seemed to me the very luxurious quality of accommodation provided. I thought this would be a nice number, you know, to do that job and be able to live in a nice flat like this with hot water all the time and air conditioning and loads of space and stuff, carpets and things. But I have to say, when it became the reality for me, I found it very frustrating, because I thought I was in a sort of ghetto of foreign diplomats who there was much sort of socializing with ourselves around the pool in the embassy compound at the weekend. And although we had some Chinese staff who supported us, it was a bubble. And I didn't find most of the people in it particularly interesting. Some I got on with well, but what frustrated me also and annoyed me was the incuriosity about China of quite a lot of the people working in, not particularly the British embassy, the embassies generally. There were some who were genuinely interested and others who it was just a step in a global career. No particular interest in experiencing China or finding out a great deal about it outside the narrow confines of their duties, whatever they were. And I found that annoying and frustrating. So I took every opportunity to escape. I remember the first long weekend I got, which was a few weeks after I arrived, one of the Chinese holiday weekends, I simply walked to the train station and took a train at random a few hundred miles and climbed Mount Tai in Shandong province. And,
the famous.
Yes, and I hadn't been there at that stage. It was my first trip to Mount Tai, and tried to mix with local Chinese people and began to feel that I'd finally arrived back in China. 6 weeks after I returned to China.
You stayed in the local. So you climbed Mount Tai and you stayed with local people.
Well, I stayed in a local Chinese hostel where foreigners and Chinese could stay.
And from then on, you got out as much as you could.
As much as I could, but as a foreign diplomat at that time in China, there were limits. To how close you could get to Chinese people without risking getting them into trouble. So much of my social life was with the international community. But fortunately, my work, the British Council, which in most of it was involved supporting Chinese students to go to the UK, it brought me a lot into contact with Chinese academics, Chinese students. So once I got into the job, I found it was actually quite interesting. It wasn't all office-based. It wasn't all in the diplomatic bubble. It was one of the most interesting jobs in the embassy at that time. And there was also quite a lot of opportunities to explore. I got a car, which was quite a rare thing in China in those days, to have a private car. And you were allowed to drive to quite a lot of places. and it was quite interesting to drive deep into the countryside, into the mountain areas, go chat to farmers and so on. So I got enough of a real China experience once I'd worked out how to do it to quite enjoy the it was nearly 4 years I was
in Beijing,
in Beijing on that first posting, so 3.5.
You were there till 91, so you were obviously there in May, June 1989, or were you abroad?
No, I was there. I actually left in December 1990, at the end of the year. No, I was in Beijing on the 4th of June. In fact, I was actually outside Beijing. I was by then I'd met my wife to be, Moira, who was in China, in Beijing, on a sort of sabbatical year, studying Chinese dance at the Dance Academy. So we were already together then, and some friends of mine were visiting from England. So we'd taken them out to visit some Eastern tombs outside Beijing, and heard on the BBC World Service that there'd been trouble in Beijing. So it took quite a few hours to drive back into the city.
You knew before you left. I mean, the Tiananmen was already occupied in May, wasn't it?
Oh, well, things have been going on for weeks.
Yeah.
We were aware, yes.
You may not want to have any reflections on your view from the ground, so to speak, there, but are there any thoughts that you want to share with the world about what you've encountered about Tiananmen? I mean, did you have friends involved with it, or who were there?
No, I didn't have friends involved with it. What I do recall is I chatted to some of the students. This was going on for weeks, and once or twice I went down and chatted to some of the students from universities that I knew about. And what struck me was the great vagueness of whatever they were demonstrating for. And I say that simply because it's what I encountered. When I ask people, why are you here? What's this about? It was a bit like me and Catholicism. They were just doing what everyone else was doing, as far as I could see. but that was my wife's experience as well, which she shared. She was at the Dance Academy in Beijing, and one day some students said, oh, let's all go to Tiananmen Square. That's what everyone's doing. I don't know. I mean, these things are in the past, but I don't really have a huge amount of evidence. But I would say, with some confidence, that quite a lot of people were involved because of imitative behaviour.
When you heard the leaders, they talked in generalities about democracy and the overthrow of this and that, but they didn't get down to many specifics, which ties in with what or saying. I mean, if you asked people what exactly they wanted, they knew what they didn't want, but did the people you talked to or the leaders appear to be aware of what they were really wanting?
I would say not, actually. And I also I don't think there was ever a particularly cogent agenda set out or any intention to set one out. I don't recall it. They seemed very normal, the students there, but also very unclear about why they were there. They had a number of complaints about, you know, the quality of food on campus to the cost of living, general dissatisfaction, but they didn't seem to me to have signed up to any particular vision of the future.
And what about the reaction of the government? I mean, there are various views about whether it was necessary to clear it, or whether that was the best way to clear it, or the use of the army and so on. Do you have any views on any of that?
I was very surprised it ended as violently as it appears to have done, simply because it seemed to me to be diminishing in intensity in the weeks prior to that.
It could have been left to fizzle out, you think?
Well, I don't know, but I was very surprised. My expectation by the end of May was that it would quietly fizzle out, as things often do. I didn't expect that it would be ended abruptly.
Mm. Then afterwards, did you notice a lot of tightening up in surveillance or anything else? Was your life affected?
It was somewhat tightened up, but particularly so in Beijing and particularly in Peking University. So I recall that for about a year afterwards, we weren't able to go into some of the university campuses. We still had to do our job. I stayed for a few days after the 4th of June as a sort of reduced embassy staff. There was quite a lot of British students that wanted to leave. Because they felt they weren't sure what would happen. There were a few who refused to leave, contrary to the wishes of their parents and their home universities in the United Kingdom, which was quite a dilemma. But there was quite a lot to do for a couple of weeks, and then there was really nothing to do because things got very quiet. So I think I went early on summer leave, and got married as planned. While I was on summer leave, but Maura and I went back to Beijing in the late summer, early autumn of 89, and to some extent for us, life returned to normal fairly quickly. I think university programs were quite affected for about a year, but most of the routine of diplomatic life and British Council life became normal again, I suppose quicker than we felt it would.
Did you stay in Beijing all the time that you were in the British Council, or?
I did 3 postings in China. That was the first. The second one was in Hong Kong in the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
But although I was living in Hong Kong by then with family, my responsibilities were in the south of mainland China, so I travelled a lot. And then the final posting as director of the British Council was from 2000 to 2007, so back in Beijing. And in between, I worked in British Council headquarters in London, generally dealing with the British Council's relationship with Whitehall.
Mm.
So it was either Mandarin or Mandarins, my 20-year career.
I mean, you're there for such a fascinating time with the sudden growth of China after 1991, 1992, Shenzhen and Shanghai and so on. People are just amazed at what the growth and the change of that period. When did you really get a sense that something extraordinary was happening?
That's quite interesting. As early as my first time in China in the early 80s, when really China, although things were clearly stirring, it was changing. There were the very small beginnings of what became the Chinese market economy. Nevertheless, most people, including myself, expected China to remain a society based on the bicycle for the rest of my lifetime. We used to joke and say, well, what would this place be like if all these cyclists had cars? I mean, no, that can't possibly happen. It's unimaginable. It would never work. Of course, it's precisely what happened, except many of them have 2 cars. On the other hand, I do remember my British colleague in Hunan days, Tanya, who'd done a degree in Chinese at Leeds and previously spent a year in Beijing as a student, who was certainly wiser to China than I was, saying that this is all going to change, and she actually broadly foresaw that China would be a rising economic power, and that would happen under the leadership of the Communist Party, and China within our lifetimes would be massively influential and rich. She was quite clear about this and precisely right, I would say, so I'll credit her with that. So that at least opened my eyes to the possibility, but I don't think I was a confident believer in China rising to the extent that it has done in the last 3 decades at that stage. Then I was back in the late 80s. I think it wasn't really until the mid-90s, when I was back in Hong Kong and looking at what was happening in South China, looking at how much money quite a lot of people seemed to have, that it occurred to me that all this stuff that was being stated about in the West at the time about how, you know, a country, a socialist country that didn't want liberal democracy couldn't possibly become very wealthy, that this was probably about to be proved wrong. And yes, I think it was the mid-90s. It was the quite dramatically growing affluence of individuals that made me feel that. And also I think that it seems to me there have been two quite different sides to the rise of China as an economic power. The one that's rather more talked about and commented on in the West is the role of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So massive national champions that have been built and gargantuan infrastructure projects, and this is very important. But the other aspect that's commented on a little less has been the release of Chinese entrepreneurial energy, which has depended on a somewhat more permissive policies gradually being implemented, but it hasn't been sort of driven by government, it's driven by individual enterprise in China. And without that, there's no way China would have achieved the economic strength that it has in such a short time. And being in South China in the mid-90s, I was very exposed particularly to that side, because as you go further south in China, it appears to me that the proportion of the state in economic growth diminishes somewhat, and the role of the private sector grows the further south you go. And it was just seeing how creative, energetic and successful people were becoming in large numbers in Guangdong and elsewhere at the time. I already knew that the Chinese government could organize large projects. I'd seen that in Beijing. But when I saw how smart at business the Cantonese had become, then I began to sort of put two and two together and decide that it might equal more than four.
It certainly has. We're now at an interesting turning point where America has become aware of what's happening, and there's quite a lot of tension and so on. So it's a time perhaps to ask you about what you think is likely to happen over the next 10 years or so in China and in its relations with the West.
Well, I find such a question difficult because I think there's a problem with predicting the future, which is that it's not predictable.
Yeah.
Because a number of things might happen.
Yes, of course.
So a prediction, if it's right, it's purely by chance.
Yes, obviously.
You're with me on that. So I'll just
all,
give
all
that
we know is that whatever you say will be wrong. But
that's also true. I try. The more precise I am, the more certain it is that I shall be wrong.
Basically, optimistic or pessimistic about the future of China?
I'm more optimistic. I actually think there's a great deal has been achieved in China in the last 40 years. I was arguing with a British friend the other day, who was teasing me now that I work part-time for a Chinese state company. It's part of my sort of retirement consultancy work. And I was sort of being quite defensive of the more positive aspects of modern China and the economic progress and the much greater freedom that most people enjoy to travel the world and choose educational pathways for their children in a way that they couldn't in the past. And it was put to me that yes, I know that they've lifted millions of people out of poverty, but. And I couldn't resist pointing out that millions was a huge underestimate. There actually hundreds of millions fewer people are poor in China than when I first went there 30 years ago. Not millions, hundreds of millions.
Mm.
And these aren't small things to be dismissed with a but, it seems to me. Whatever one feels about any other aspect of China, there's a difference between misery and some degree of well-being and prosperity for quite a significant proportion of our species.
One tenth of the world.
We shouldn't belittle it for the sake of political purposes. I believe that quite strongly. I think also that rising educational levels in China, which is it's like the economic progress. It's been it's a combination effect of quite well organized top-down policies and huge individual effort and commitment. So that commitment to learning from families and young people, combined with some policies that have made many years of state education free and of reasonable quality compared to many countries, is actually leading to significant advances in educational level of the very large numbers of Chinese people. And that I suppose is my main basis for optimism. Clearly China has huge problems, particularly of environmental degradation. Not only China, but China perhaps particularly has very large scale problems of that kind, and problems I think in also that its well-being has depended on very high levels of economic growth, which hardly anyone, including in China, thinks are sustainable for much longer. So those are enormous challenges that China faces. But I think the biggest, the best basis for optimism is simply that most people are much smarter than people were 30 years ago. They know a lot more, they can do a lot more. And that to me is very important. Of course, I've worked in education for most of my life.
Well, I think that's probably a very good point to end on, but I should note that we've missed out the last 12 years of your life here, during which you've held several very important jobs with the Cambridge Trusts and with Cambridge Education. And if we had another hour, we could fill it with all that. But it was really China that I wanted to talk to you about, because I've always been impressed by your extraordinary linguistic ability in Chinese and your interest in China. So on that point, I would just like to wish you all success in the next 20 years. So thank you very much indeed, Michael.
Thank you, Alan.